quick plug real quick if you guys are good with that.
Yeah.
There's, you know, anytime I get stressed out, there's this place I love to go. It's called Club Albi. A-L-B-E-E.
Was that A-L-B-E?
E-E. Okay. Yeah, A-L-B-E-E, Club Albi. Join us on Facebook, clubalbi.com, or facebook.com/clubalbi.
/groups.
Never been there before, personally, but I've heard about it on the radio, so I figured.
Yeah.
Club Albi, okay.
Yeah. Club Albi, yeah. A-L-B-E-E.
Oh, nice.
See, this rings deeply for me back to early days where it's 5:30 in the morning. I'm on the bus on the way to school at Seaworth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's an hour-long bus ride. And I'm just listening to the radio and just hearing all these wonderful ads about Club Albi. And I'm like, is this why I'm going to school? Is this what's desirable? Is this what adults do?
Yeah.
Just an open-minded young boy. And
I guess that's what Oklahoma adults do. They go to Club Albi, bro.
Yeah.
Club Albi.
Well, not anymore. All the Club Albi goers, they've had a bad run these last 18 months. Yeah. Rest in peace. Good. Thank God for TikTok. Where else would you dance these days?
That's true. Dude, that's I've been a getting very it. Good point. Dude, I was just telling him like an hour ago, I've not TikTok dances, but I have a new appreciation for dancers. It's become this new thing where I found it on Instagram and I'm like, that's kind of sick. And so I follow a few people and I'm like, I never thought I would be my age and looking at people dancing, but I'm like, this is cool. I appreciate this.
Well, you really appreciate it when you try it, because then you're like, I have no rhythm in my body. Mm-hmm. Like, I can't do any of this. So it becomes a lot more impressive. You get a new perspective.
For sure. Yes. Yeah. Agree.
I don't know. I'm a pretty good dancer, but I'm also, I fit the profile of that person who like thinks they're a good dancer.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And everyone likes to laugh at them, but like they're not actually good.
I'm sure you could.
But people are like, no, keep on dancing. We like when you dance.
Yeah. Like at a wedding or something.
Well, you know, who judges what's good? What's good is what people enjoy, right? Mm.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It depends on your crowd.
And if people keep asking you to dance, that means you're a good dancer.
Yeah. Can't let them down. That's what I always say.
And see, depending on where you are, like maybe just throwing elbows, maybe that's what people will admire and like. And I can do both extremes. You know?
Yeah.
Anything, a man that can do both.
Yeah.
Anything becomes a mosh pit when you start throwing bows.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's true. So Caleb, I wanted to ask you about, obviously you're near the end of medical school, if that is obvious. It is to me. But
how long have you been?
Because the pathway from like you thinking maybe I want to become a doctor, to like actually getting in medical school, like that's probably the stretch of time that most people get knocked out of the race.
Give up or something.
So like, how'd you make it through? And like, I don't know.
No, that's honestly an excellent question. I think it just comes down to like what your level of determination is, because I've always thought like anybody could do it. And that's true. Like that really is true. There are some people who have like legitimate learning disorders. And in those cases, you know, maybe not. But like I knew I wanted to do medicine ever since I was like a kid. You know, my dad really, he just busted his ass his entire life, you know, working and hurting his back. And he would, you know, he always told us like, you know, my worst nightmare is that like I wake up and come to work one day and you guys are there, like us being his children.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy. When did he tell you that?
He told me that when I was probably like 12.
I feel like I remember you telling me that before. Yeah. That's.
And what did your dad do?
So he works at a company called Associated Wholesale Grocers. He works basically just in like a grocery warehouse.
Gotcha.
That like ships out to like Crest and Walmart and stuff like that. But I mean, it's hard labor. I mean, you get to work the forklift if you're lucky, right?
Right.
But otherwise you're lifting and you're putting, you know, pallets of groceries onto trucks that are going out to grocery stores and
warehouse work. Seems like you could gain some muscle from it, but you really just gain back problems.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason.
From working at one for only like 5 or 6 years.
Not, yeah.
Not that long considering some of the people who do work in warehouses.
Right. Like, right, for sure. And I mean, there's a reason why like you see a lot of warehouse workers wearing back braces. Like it's hard. It's hard work. And like I have so much respect for people who do that for a living. Like they're stronger than I'll ever be. But my dad just told me that, and I kind of had like a natural talent for school. I don't know. Numbers made sense to me. I loved science. And so like I had a few people who just told me like, you know, you could do something real with your life. You know, you could be a lawyer, you could be a doctor, you could be an engineer, you could, you know, whatever you want to do. And, you know, I'd never been told that before. And so it kind of made me stop and think like, you know, what do I want to do? And so I was always interested in like human anatomy as a kid. And so I was like, well, I want to know how the body works. And then, like my oldest brother, Chris, he, had spina bifida and like he was in and out of the hospital with surgeries like all the time. And so we would go visit him in the hospital and like just seeing, you know, the doctors there who were taking care of him. Like I just felt this like huge sense of respect that like your family member sitting in a bed, you know, and a lot of the times it can be life or death. And like the person who's in charge of their health and like makes these critical life or death decisions is the physician. And so I was like, well, I want to do that. And so like, I always knew through high school, that's what I was going to do, but I had the extra challenge of being homeschooled. Right. I mean, it's really hard to have connections. I had no advisors in high school.
Right.
You know, it's just my mom.
It's crazy. The amount of homeschool guests we're going to have. We will have
so many more.
I'm sure
too.
This has come up so many times,
but I think it's great because and I think
like, I didn't even think about it until now, but
I didn't even think I forget who played on the football team too. Like I even forgot Landon play, and I shouldn't have. Like it's just, you kind of
forget. His dad was the coach.
Yeah. That too. Like his dad was the coach like for like 3 or 4 years. I had to talk to Coach Sykes.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's cool because I think we have a cool group of friends that all share this like very strange way of, not strange, but different way of being brought up.
And it's such a spectrum too. Like one person's homeschooling experience can be completely opposite from others. You see one side of the spectrum where people just like have no social skills, are afraid to interact with any of their peers, think that public schoolers are heathens and that they're going to go to hell for talking to them. And, and then you get people who are more like socially adjusted and people who can kind of incorporate into society without making a fool of themselves all the time.
Or being petrified.
Yeah. Like yeah. And said. Then of course there's everything in between, but, but yeah, so being homeschooled definitely was a bit of a challenge for me. No one in my family really went to college. And so like, I just had this dream and I just told myself that like not getting it wasn't an option. It was a matter of time. Like that's the way I saw it. It wasn't like, if this doesn't work out, then I'll do this. It was a determination that was like unwavering. Like I just knew it was going to happen eventually. It was just, how am I going to make it happen? And so like I went to a vo-tech in high school, Francis Tuttle. And that was like for people who wanted to be pre-med in college and knew it already. It like taught us like study skills and a lot of advanced placement classes and stuff like that to just kind of prepare us for the rigors of college. And then when I got into college, you know, and it's wild because when I started that program, you know, there were like 25 kids in like the freshman class. But by the time we graduated, the program had weeded it out to like 5 graduating students. Whoa. Yeah. And even, and that's just high school, you know, college, you go to college, I swear to God, half of people in college are pre-med, right? Like they have on their Instagram, like it's kind of a meme in like the medical school culture, like pre-meds in college will put like on their Instagram profile, like future pediatric cardiothoracic neurosurgeon, you know? And then it's like, if they even get into medical school, then they just end up, you know, probably not doing that because it's altogether not a real field. But,
I've matched with a few people on Tinder that have that in their bio. That's funny that you mentioned that.
Oh, that's a bad sign. That's a sign that, that's a sign of irrational optimism, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, like you can have the brightest minds, but if you aren't the type of person who can mesh well with people and you don't have like emotional intelligence, you're not going to get into medical school. Like it's, you can be the best test taker in the world and no one's going to take you if you don't know how to talk to people. That's kind of a new movement they've gone through, like in medicine and in medical school. They're trying to look at applicants. It's hard not to look at applicants as a number, right? Because there's thousands of them.
Right.
It's hard to not just assign them a number to judge them by. So they're trying to do more like character traits and stuff like that. And interviews are having more, are being more heavily weighted on admission and stuff. But yeah, so all through college, you know, I had tons of friends that were like pre-med with me. And as each year, each semester went by, you know, you'd ask them like, hey man, how are you doing? Or how are things going? And like, oh, well, I'm not going to do pre-med anymore. So a lot of people drop out. Like it's just really, you know, freshman year weeds out probably like half of them. The sophomore, probably half of those, junior, half of those, senior. I mean, it's
just like an exponential step down each semester.
It's like when you're, it's like, you know, you see like, I don't know if you remember that episode of SpongeBob where SpongeBob and Patrick are running from Sandy. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, you're both running away so fast. And then you just look over and like he gets lassoed and just like disappears. Mm-hmm. That's essentially what you and all your friends are just like on this run race to medical school. Like you're just trying to get there and you just look left and right and people are just being picked off left and right. And you know, so it really is crazy. And then even then, if you finish college pre-med, you know, you got to apply. I had to apply twice. So it's, you know, dang. Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to do. But again, when I didn't get in the first time, it wasn't a matter of if, it was a matter of when. Mm. Right. So I found a job. Did whatever I could to better my application and, whether it was volunteering hours, whether it was getting letters of recommendations from physicians, anything I could do. And I think that's really ultimately what it takes. I mean, it's
so hard. There's just like all this stuff you're mentioning. There's so many soft skills in there and like reaching out, trying to network people.
Yeah.
But really the root of all of it is like being super intentional that like, this is what I'm going to do. I'm staking everything on it. And I'm putting it on myself to figure it out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And like this is really echoing a lot of things like from my journey, just going from like, oh, I'm trying to be a self-taught programmer. Like you start there and there's just a market of 100 million people.
Yeah.
And then along the way, there's just bodies like all around.
Yeah.
And like so very few people will make it through. And then when you make it through and like you get your first offer, you just look back and you're like, oh my God, I just made it through a minefield.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel no credit. Yeah. Or well, like credit for like your hard work, but it's, you're also like, I kind of got lucky.
Yeah.
Almost not to say that's you, you definitely busted your ass, but it's just, it's such a crazy hard race to run and they almost incentivize you to not do it.
Yeah, no, that's
because you lose money and you lose time trying to do this, and there's a small probability you make it.
That's why they have something that they literally teach you in orientation to medical school called imposter syndrome, because you had to work so hard to be there. Some people barely got in. I barely got in, right? So you think like you look around you and of course a lot of people have like this self-doubting where it's like you see other people and you're like, wow, they're in medical school. They probably got in no problem and they're probably way smarter than me. But literally every person sitting there, except for a few cocky bastards that are like, of course I got in, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
There's some of those, but the vast majority of people don't feel like they belong. Like you feel like, like, okay, I'm in medical school. If I finish this, like I'm going to be a doctor. And there's no, like, that's weird. You're like, I shouldn't be a doctor. I'm just a normal person. Right. Or you're like, I'm not smart enough to do this. And it's like so ubiquitous throughout that field that they literally are like, no, like you may feel this way, but like you're here for a reason. Like you worked hard. It's hard to do, but like you've done it. And so everyone else above you who is, you know, in the field had to do exactly what you did and feels exactly the same way you feel. But I also feel like back to what you were saying, like moving through like the minefield of like with programming, like I feel like you went through a far, like you trailblazed, right? Like you went through a path that like not a lot of people go through. For me, it was like, okay, go to high school, right? Do my best to try and get into a good college.
Well, there's only one path for like becoming a doctor. You have to tread the long path. And like, this is what we were talking about with Landon, like the same thing with what he's doing, counseling. There's basically only one path, but it's like me, I just have to get, It's crazy. I just have to get people to think I'm the perfect hire.
Yeah.
It's like I have to make myself become or look like exactly what would be the perfect hire for a junior software engineering role. And that's like a much different proposition. Yeah, you have to learn skills, but kind of inherent in that is I'm going to have to sell myself. I'm going to have to network. I'm going to have to work on all these things. But becoming a doctor, you kind of just think like, okay, I'm going to learn my craft and like learn the anatomy. But actually becoming a doctor is also that. It's long, and there's the soft skills and the networking, mm-hmm. and the senior doctors or whatever have to like you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a way, like, yeah, maybe I trailblazed through, but it's a way different. I couldn't have ran the marathon. I mean, if I really cared about it, like you do.
Yeah.
So that's the only way to run the marathon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like you could have, though. Like, that's my point. Like, it's a well-beaten path, right? Everyone goes down it. You got to make sure that you check the boxes, right? But and what makes the difference between who gets there and who doesn't is mm-hmm. who decides it's worth it. Mm-hmm. Like, it is really hard. And mm-hmm. I even have classmates, like, I'm not going to name them, but like have said, like, you know, if I had to go back, I don't think I'd do it again. You know, like if I had to go back and reapply, I would, do PA or do nursing or go into research or something. You know, they were like, honestly, because it is hard and it's like, it's taxing. Mm-hmm. But it just boils down to like, are you determined enough to do it? Are you willing to put in the work to learn all these random facts you have to know for these random tests and, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I would argue that like what you've gone through is scarier, because for me, it's like I see the path before me and I just got to do it. But like what you went through, it's awesome. Like, it's like you're finding your way like in a trail that not many people have done. And it's a very unique to you trail.
You're cutting through with a machete.
Yeah. You're the dude walking through hacking stuff down with a machete, and I'm walking on a paved road. You know what I mean? It's like, it's cool. They're different journeys, which each have their own different challenges, but mm-hmm. I'm never going to make it sound like people who go into medicine are like better than anybody else or smarter than anybody else. Mm-hmm. Because if you guys had the exact same schooling that I had, you'd know exactly what I know. Mm-hmm. You know, there's nothing special about me except that I tried.
Who's willing to actually do it and be it.
Yeah. You know? Who's willing. Yeah. You just can't be willing to give up, because there's a lot of discouragement and a lot of small losses that can build up, and eventually you quit. And that's when people are like, oh yeah, I was pre-med, but I'm not anymore. They chose not to be. Right. No one told them they couldn't be.
Right.
You know? So that's really what it boils down to.
I wish touring musicians had a lesson on imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
Something you said that resonated with me so much is, people that are all doing the same thing, and they all kind of, maybe they took different paths to become a touring musician, but you all are just people playing music at the end of the day. And everyone started playing for like two people.
Yeah.
You know, like,
absolutely.
Everyone has done that. There's very few that skyrocket straight to the top. But like that really resonated
with me. Well, and it's crazy. That. In first week of Lambda school, they introduce us to imposter syndrome and they start talking about it from the bat. And yeah, like that, it's so important to recognize everyone who is in the position felt like how you did. So how you're feeling is actually part of the process.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's actually a filter. Like, what helps me think about, especially like learning how to code, what was a weird motivator, and maybe it's kind of icky and kind of a guy thing, like a competitive type of thing, but I would think of like each hard next thing I had to learn is like a filter. Like, everyone's trying to run to the top of the hill and there's like barricades in the way. And like each, when you learn this language or when you learn how to do this certain operation or whatever, like, and it's so hard, I would just think like, okay, but this is the hurdle that's going to make like whatever 20% of the people quit. Like, am I going to be one of those 20%? Or like, how much more am I setting myself apart each time? And knowing that imposter syndrome is kind of part of it, because you kind of are an imposter.
Yeah.
Like, that's what, they just don't tell you like, hey, this is what you have to be in order to become this. You have to be an imposter that also learns the stuff
and keeps on
doing it. Like, that's the path.
Yeah.
And so, could probably talk about just that whole domain for hours.
But for real though, like, imposter syndrome is not just for musicians and medical students and, you know, like, software engineers. Like, I feel like to an extent, like, anyone who's starting something new, who has like little experience in it, is going to feel some sort of like not belonging. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's a lot of people, probably anyone who could hear this, who could find the way that imposter syndrome, you know, relates to them, and it goes anywhere. I mean, anyone can feel it for any reason, but it's important to recognize that it is just like, it's a feeling and it's not a reality. You know?
Yeah, that is the most important
Yeah.
Part of it, I think. Yeah. Recognizing that it's not reality. It's not, it's just temporary.
Yeah.
You just got to push through it.
And if you're feeling it, congratulations, because that means that you're doing something that's kind of scary and something that some place you thought you would never be or some place you never thought you deserved to be, but you're there now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you do deserve it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Another thing that Lambda gave us, like a mental model, is like, they would frame it exactly what you're talking about, that discomfort. They would say there's the comfort zone, which is not the learning zone.
Yeah.
The discomfort zone, which is the learning zone. You want to spend some time here every day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the panic zone, which is red, which is like, that's too much. Get help. Yeah. Take a step back at that point.
Right.
And they're like, go into the discomfort zone and go back down. Go in and go back down. Like almost like a graph, and you venture into it. And that way you frame your discomfort as like, okay, I'm in it. Mm-hmm. This is hard. Like I'm almost in pain because my mind is focused and I'm aware that like these details are hard or they're intimidating or whatever. But that's also the process that makes you remember it. It's like branding it into your memory.
Mm-hmm.
So it's weird. It's not, I wish adults would have told me this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Told me the kind of dynamics that like, it seems that every easy choice has a bad outcome.
Yeah.
And it seems that a lot of things that are difficult to do actually are what have good outcomes. Like, no one kind of explained that to me, like, pretty simply.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I guess you have to figure it out for yourself.
You do, but at the same time, like, if you were to ask my opinion, I think that, like, these types of, like, I would even consider it, like, a humanities-type course that you could add into high school. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Just to teach about like different experiences.
Self-worth,
learn something about culture, you know, learn how to do taxes, you know, like things that's like everyone's going to grow up and who cares if you know that the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell when you graduate, but you don't know.
You don't know how to deal with your own mental struggles.
You don't know like, what the world's going to look like outside. How do you pay bills? How do you do this? Like there need to be more like practical skills and things that like focus on like bettering people. You know, just self-worth and I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Totally. I mean, me and Jana talk about this a lot because she really feels like school made her ill-prepared and that school is producing a lot of people. I say school, the university system in the U.S. is producing a lot of people who are really kind of dysfunctional and specialized in mostly useless areas. But not just like a balanced, like functional person. And then the job field is just an absolute, just fucking slaughterhouse, you know, just it's terrible right now, especially if you come out with a humanities degree.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
for sure.
Which that's kind of depressing in my opinion. It almost seems like we need more people, kind of like what you were saying, implementing in a high school, like we need more people that are focused on like people's, mental health, people's like how they deal with life.
I mean, if I was if I was trying to hire someone for my company, I would rather have someone who's like more well-rounded with a humanities degree than someone who just like got their degree in biology and they're like, I know about plants and animals. And it's like, well, cool, but like, you know, that's not going to help you.
Yeah,
yeah, but your humanities grad might also like spray paint your business and break the windows.
That, you know, yeah, that's true. That there's probably some of those that would do that.
But we don't have to go there at all.
But not all hashtag not all humanities majors.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. There you go.
And if you ever are feeling stressed out enough to, you know, spray paint stuff, smash stuff, take out that energy at Club Albee.
A-L-B-E-E.
Well, now that Club Alley is shut down, we have to
reopening it, though.
Burn down the city. Okay,
there you go. That could be our first sponsor.
Yeah, Club Albee.
Dang.
Go that there. That would honestly be crazy. Yeah. Would we have to like mix in some song? Or, I don't know. I guess
I'll make it.
We'll work on some ads.
Yeah.
For like, what do you think Club Albee sells? Like,
what it drinks. Sounds like?
What do they sell? Club Albee
for $2 a week.
They sell like... all week. Like yoga.
It's an oxygen
subscription boxes.
It's an oxygen bar.
Yes.
Oxygen bar subscription boxes.
Yeah.
An opium den.
Opium den.
Yeah, yeah.
That's more my kind of place. Dude, in Oregon, I think you can smoke.
Oh yeah, isn't that That's crazy. I keep hearing stuff about Oregon.
Oh, yeah, like, that they legalized. Well, no.
It's a certain city in Oregon that legalized everything, right?
Or is it the whole under state? Under medical supervision, or I have no idea. Maybe that's, it's only clinical.
That's, what a job. Yeah. I mean, so like...
To give people drugs?
Like opium overdoses, the reason people overdose is because it like decreases your respiratory drive. So you essentially just stop breathing. So... I mean, but there's they have like what's called Narcan. It's just a nasal spray. You just ram it up their nose and you know, and then it just completely reverses it. So I'm assuming that medical supervision means just like some teenager with a Narcan, like, are you still breathing? Like,
just squirting it.
It's like, if you stop breathing, you know, 6 breaths per minute or less, I'm going to give you some Narcan.
Jeez.
What a job.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to be a Narcan guy. It's like being the towel boy.
A Narcan technician.
Yeah, Narcan ninja just jumps in there. And...
It's like the film, the camera guy for a porno. You're just like, you're not in on the action, but you're like right there. You got to get up in it. Oh, especially if shit gets real. Sorry. But but you know, back to basically okay, applying
put a weird image in my mind now. It's hard to hear what you're saying.
Yeah, I know. I love to get too far off a rabbit hole and then jump right back to just what we were talking about.
Nose dive right into it off the high dive.
As a listener, I enjoy it when that happens. So
yeah.
Well, if y'all hate that, DM me. So like getting into medical school, you said you applied once, you didn't get in.
Mm-hmm.
You apply, like how many times can you apply? Do you have to like pay, like, or how many people even get, like people say medical school, but they're like, what is that, a place? Is it a secret organization?
Yeah. So medical school, I mean, technically it has to be an institution that can grant you either an MD, which is medical degree, or a DO, which is a doctor of osteopathy. So
what is osteopathy?
So it's all down into history, right? So a DO, I will never speak poorly of them because they get essentially the exact same education that MDs get, with an additional, what they call like musculoskeletal manipulation. So I think back in the day, it was like chiropractors, right?
Oh, okay.
Like you learn how to like adjust the back, and they still learn those things to this day with the addition of like the medicine that we would learn in MD schools. So they technically learn more than we do. But just with the history, given that they were basically chiropractors who would, you know, try to say they could cure diseases by adjusting your back, which... Mm-hmm. That's not to say that chiropractors don't do real work, because they do. But if they're ever like, oh, I'm going to cure your diabetes by adjusting your lumbar spine, you're like, no, that's that's definitely not how that works. And, you know, but so there was that. There's that stigma. So Oklahoma has one DO school and one MD school. And so I'm part of the MD program in Oklahoma. But yeah, like, so there's a limited number of seats. I think at OU there's 165 seats a year. And there's somewhere around almost 5,000 applicants for those 165 Whoa. Seats. Yeah. So, I mean, like a lot of people try. Now, that's also people across the country who shoot out 50 applications.
Mm-hmm.
I will forever be like, I'll have the opinion, though, that a lot of what makes the difference between like people who can easily get into medical school and people who can't has a lot to do with privilege, to be honest. So like for me, I got in off the wait list. I applied my first time. I was misguided by our pre-med advisor, who told me I needed to do things that I actually should have been doing different things, right? So that's why it didn't work out for me the first time. The second time, my MCAT, which is the medical college admissions test, it's not a pass or fail thing. It's kind of like an ACT. You get a numerical score and then you apply to medical school with that number, and they'll either say, you know, this is good or this isn't. But I didn't do well on that test. I was working a full-time job trying to pay off the course I had to buy to study for the test.
Jeez.
Right. And I had to work. I had to work. I had to have a job. There are a lot of people who are fortunate. And again, I'm not saying that people who have privilege don't deserve it, because, you know, they absolutely do. If you got into medical school, you worked hard.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, they have parents who are able to pay for their living, pay for their bills, pay for their car, pay for everything. And they can just say, hey, you know, use this 4 months to study for the MCAT. And they get 90-something percentile scores. And they're just like, excellent. And it's like, great. Some of us had to work a full-time job. Some of us had to work 40 hours a week, and we had to study with whatever extra time we could have on top of that. And that's where I was, because I don't have, my family doesn't have money. Right. Like, my family's been able to take care of me and provide for me, and I'm, like, eternally grateful to them for that. But there was never a whole lot of financial privilege for me. And so some people, you know, you find out like, oh yeah, my dad or my mom's a doctor, or both of them, or they're lawyers. And it's like, that's excellent. And that is so good for them, you know, and I'm not going to speak poorly on them for that. But there's definitely that sense of like, it's really hard to pull yourself up from the dirt and just be like, I'm going to get in. I'm going to go from someone who has no status or prestige in their family, and then attain one of the most prestigious fields that you can get, that you can do. You know, it's very hard. And that's why I think it took me some extra time. I didn't have proper guidance. I didn't have the financial means, you know, and again, applying for medical school is expensive. People are having to take out loans because it costs like some schools cost like $150 for a primary application. Oh. So for every school you choose to apply to, that's money, right? Oh my gosh. And then for another reason, they also will send you a secondary application, right? So it's like, oh yeah, we liked your primary application. Now, you know, write us some essays for why you want to go to this school and why we should choose you. So then you got to write those, and you got to spend like $70 for every secondary you send back. So again, some people can only afford to apply to three schools, right? Other people can afford to can afford to apply to 50. Your chances of getting in when you're applying to 50 different places are way greater than if you were just to apply to your home program, right? And so that's another area where it's like, if you don't have the money, you just can't do it. Like, you can't apply.
That's frustrating.
It's very frustrating.
Like, starting from nothing and having to scrap your way up. A lot of things force you to do that. Like, if you're starting from, you don't have money saved up, you don't have any privilege, almost anything you want to do that's totally different or totally out of your element, you have to just fight those tides and know that you have to give away all your time, and other people, they just have, you know, free time to do it. I mean, it was the same thing in Lambda. Like, some people, they didn't have a job along with it, so they could just dedicate their full time just already searching for jobs early. And then me, I'm like listening to videos while I'm taking deliveries and like trying to brush up and shit. And you're just like, oh my God, like, this is so unfair. And you see like those people, they'll get like sometimes like exponentially ahead. And just make more and more progress. And you're like, oh.
Dude, it's the same thing with people in bands that have families that can just like,
oh yeah,
be like, oh, you want to go on a month long tour? Don't worry about it. We got your car payment. We got your like rent. Don't worry about it.
I remember, not to mention all the equipment that they would have to.
Yeah, like you would meet these people, and you're like spending $3 a day at Taco Bell. Like, haven't showered since Tuesday. Yeah. It's Friday, and you're like, wait, what? You pulled up in a just like
one of the fancy like vans,
big, huge. Yeah, I don't know. It's wild. Man. It's wild to meet those people sometimes. Yeah. Good for them, but it's wild.
Yeah,
dude. I remember there was a certain band that is just like what you described from here. Like, their parents.
There's a couple.
I'm sure there's a couple. Maybe Sabretooth. The other.
No,
not them.
No, never.
They look like they work on the oil rig.
Oh, the other. Oh, okay, the other band that's now named that. That's what you mean.
Yeah,
the newer one.
There's a new band from Oklahoma called Sabretooth.
Yeah, Turf War, baby.
Yeah, they have no fucking idea whose door they're knocking.
You have no idea you're messing with, fellas.
Yeah, they just knocked on the coffin door. But okay, there's a certain band that's just like that. Like, their parents paid for them to go on tour with this like really big band and all of that. And we always like heard of them and we're like, oh, fuck them, and hate on them, whatever. But at the same time, I worked at Panera, and there was this old couple that would always come in like right before 5 minutes before close, and then like eat inside and leave a bunch of trash. Like, they would do it like three nights a week.
Yeah.
And I found
it's their thing. Come on, man.
A strange set of circumstances happened, and we ended up playing a Galardia house show at one point. And we were inside of this house loading in, and the people that were hosting, the house show where it's the band, the very privileged band. And then when I was loading in my stuff in the house, I looked at a family picture and I saw that it was the same family. And I was like, oh my God.
That's so funny.
What a crazy.
I was like, I'm in the stronghold of my oppressors right now. That's what I thought at the time. But
that's when you do an Upper Decker in their bathroom.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, make them or every up. Bathroom.
I couldn't even find the bathroom in that place. Honestly, yeah, I got kind of lost looking like, for
the
bathroom.
I'm lost in the wine cellar.
Yeah.
I'm losing signal.
I'm in the butler's closet, whatever they call that.
I thought this was the study. It's a huge bird cage. Just like they have 30 canaries in here.
And sometimes they're always the easiest to see is the people that have an unfair advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, like, that feel, I guess I'm saying I definitely relate to that.
Yeah.
But at that point, it kind of goes back to you just got to push through that. Like, those people are always going to exist. People like us and other people are always going to exist. You just kind of have to keep moving through it no matter what.
And there's something about it. There's something about the merit of, like, not getting there with, you know, riding someone's coattails and not having that privilege. Like,
yeah.
I think that for anybody who like went to medical school and, you know, within my field, like, should be proud of themselves. But there's times where, like, and I try not to be arrogant about it because I don't want to give off any vibe of like, I think I'm better than someone else because I have more education or I'm going to make more money than them one day. Like, I always try to be very careful of not being that way. But behind closed doors at home, sometimes I'm just like, you know, just think about it. I'm like, hell yeah, man. I'm so proud of myself. Like,
that's cool.
Have anyone boosting me there. Like, I didn't have, like, I went from just like your average Joe standpoint. And then I'm not saying like that I'm not an average Joe because I absolutely am. But I went from that like type of leverage where it's just like, you don't have anyone who is trying to help you out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't have anyone on your side. Like, you're just like, I'm going to try to get this. And so, you know, sometimes it's just like getting there without, I mean, no one gets to where they are like without some sort of help, right? Everyone needs help, and there's no problem asking for help. And if you're in a situation where you have like an advantage and privilege, like, there's no shame in using it, right? Mm-hmm. But there is also that extra bit of gratification you get when you didn't have that option, but you still made it. Like, that's, it feels so good. Like, I'm sure, Austin, that you're feeling that same way, like, that you just like had to work. You had to find your own path. You had to do everything yourself. You know, and that's the way I feel. And so it's just, there's just something that a lot of like self-worth and a lot of gratification doing that. So I wouldn't change it. I mean, I want my family to have the best, but like,
yeah,
it feels good earning what I've earned, you know,
but you still got a lot of hardship ahead of you.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like, you're, how much longer do you have before you're officially a doctor?
So I'll be officially a doctor. I think it's in May 2022. So, just right around a year.
Wow.
That's when I'll graduate with my MD. Whoa. But I'll be an intern. I'll make like not good money. I mean, it's like probably, I think they say it's usually like $50,000 a year, which is good. That's good money.
Right.
But you're working 80 plus hours a week.
Yeah.
So, when I say not good money, I mean not good hourly pay.
Yeah, like, for the amount of work you're putting
for the amount of work you're doing and the amount of like stress.
Right.
I mean, like, you're the guy that's sitting there, someone comes in with heart failure, you know, and it's like, oh, they've got too much fluid on their lungs. Like, I need to give them like a water pill, but how much do I give? You give them too much, they'll get dehydrated, their kidneys could fail and they could die. You don't give them enough, they could go into respiratory failure and die. And so it's like, jeez, everything you're doing is like, could be
high stakes.
Yeah, I mean, everything's high stakes. So the amount of pressure you're under constantly, and, you know, having family, like, I have a wife and a son.
Right.
And, like, that's going to be a lot of time spent away from them.
Mm.
So monetarily, it doesn't feel like that much. But, you know, eventually it'll be more. You just got to get, like, certified, and you got to do your training. There's always more training, you know. Mm-hmm. Finish medical school, people are like, oh, you're a doctor. Like, it's kind of like an unspoken code between like interns, which intern is your first year out of medical school. You are technically a physician, but you're still kind of in training. And then residency is after your intern year. If you've seen someone who's like a year or two out of like out of medical school and you're like, oh, hey, Dr. Nichols, they'll be like, oh, don't call me that. Just call me Chance. You know what I mean? Like, it's like, call me this because I don't feel like I'm a doctor yet. Right. Mm-hmm. Cause you just, you know, you're so fresh out of school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, yeah. And then of course the loans, you know, that's something I've had to get through undergrad and medical school, both with loans. I mean,
so you're probably a good quarter of a million. You don't have to reveal my friend.
I am past a quarter of a million.
Oh, that was nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a decent sized lottery's worth medical school and undergraduate loan debt. So that's great. But I mean, you make good
money. It's
more, money
it's as more a, pressure, right, though.
Yeah. I mean, you basically just pay on interest throughout your residency so that it doesn't just like completely consume you. And then usually after that, you just keep living life as you were a resident and just aggressively pay off your student loans so they don't swallow you, because they will swallow you. Like, there are some people who pay their minimum payment, you know, every month for 10 years, and then their student loan balance has either not gone down or it's even gone up. You know, it's like, yeah, the interest rates can be so crazy that you can be making the minimum payment and it's just your balance is just stays right there.
Wow.
And so
it's bad. And that goes back to basic financial education.
Yeah.
And like those loans are terrible because they can follow you till you retire.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll even take your pension money.
Oh yeah.
My gosh. This is all very new information to me. I knew all of that happened, but I didn't know the scope of it. You know, I've never looked at it at this perspective.
Yeah. I mean, if you have if you're $500,000 in debt and you have whatever, 10% interest, which isn't outside of how it is sometimes, you have 10% interest, you know, that's $50,000, you know, that's a lot.
It's a, yeah.
Is that, $50,000? $50,000.
Well, if you're, wait, what did you say? If you have
$500,000 loan, $50,000, that's your 10% interest. If you're not catching up with that and paying so that interest will lower.
Yeah.
You're running against water, you're treading water almost. Yeah.
I mean, and there are some physicians that make $50,000 a month.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. And so it's like, you take 5,000 of that to live nicely for that month, right? And then you just shred the rest of the 45,000 into, because I mean, on a monthly basis, once you've paid your interest for that payment, you know, like everything else goes towards the principal. Mm-hmm. So making big aggressive payments just knocks down that principal, which in turn knocks down the interest. So that's the way to do it. But it's hard once you've been struggling, you're finally making good money. You're like, I want to buy land. I want to buy a house. I want to buy a car. And it's like, nah, hang on.
Yeah.
Don't worry. You'll get to live a good life when you're 50. Like, you know, like,
yeah. After you get bled on and pissed on and shit on for 40 years.
Physically and, you know, emotionally, I'll say that too.
Do they make you, since you're like going through various, I guess, sessions where you're like shadowing doctors and like kind of working in a certain area for a period of time, do they have you do like the dirty work?
This is getting into the questions I want to ask.
Yeah. You guys ask away for sure. No, yeah, we definitely do the scrub work for sure.
Oh.
So I'm on surgery right now. That's the clerkship I'm on. And so there was one time we walk into the OR.
Wait, do you participate in surgery?
Oh, yeah, dude.
At all?
I'm scrubbed in. I'm suturing. I'm doing like basically the only thing I'm not doing is like cutting vital organs or blood vessels.
Okay, what does it smell like when someone's open? Like, but they're alive.
So
I'm curious too.
There is no smell unless you perforate a bowel.
Ooh.
So just someone opening up. So like the thing that would cause smell is bacteria, right? But like your abdominal cavity is sterile in normal circumstances, unless you have an infection or an abscess. So you open it up. Really all you can smell is like the iodine wash that they put to sterilize. Everything is sterile. The room and the air in the OR is constantly circulating so that it's just like filtered and circulating. So like everything, so you're not getting a bunch of dust, you're not getting like mold and stuff.
A dust bunny falls in your,
but it would, like it would, like that would happen.
That's so funny.
And so,
the janitor,
he didn't get hair from home or something.
So in general, there is no smell. Like, it's just this mm-hmm. this sterility of it. I did nice. Watch and participate in a colostomy. One of the patients, all just for, you know, HIPAA violation and not giving anything away. I'm not going to give away any identifying features, so don't come at me. But a patient had like rectal cancer. Mm-hmm. So they had tumors that had grown so extensively in the rectum, which is the most terminal part of your colon, that they weren't able to like pass bowel movements, right? Wow. And so what happens is that's an obstruction. Your bowels will get big. They can get infected. They can perforate. So what they do is they do a colostomy. I'm sure like some people have heard of a colostomy bag or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a bag. They basically take your intestine and they pick it up and they cut it open. And then they suture the edges of that cut to your skin to create basically Whoa. So that your colon leaks out into your skin rather than down there. So that offers like an escape mm-hmm. for like all the fecal matter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? And then you have to switch out that bag.
And you have to switch out the bag. And like that Whoa. Comes, that becomes your way. Some of them are temporary. Some of them mm-hmm. are permanent. Wow. But I was sitting in the OR or standing. There's no sitting. And they grabbed the transverse colon. And they were just like, okay, like let's make this incision. And it was pretty like, you know, it was pretty full, the mm-hmm. colon. And they go and they cut into it. And there was just this big like, and it's exactly what you would think. It is like, what is air in the colon?
Yeah.
But a
yeah.
fart, right? Yeah. So essentially this patient just like ripped ass in our face. And it smelled exactly like that. So I was like, all right, yeah.
Just but really, you ripped their ass.
Yeah. we got tooted on big time. yeah, and so that's pretty wild. I also, there was what's called a wound debridement. This is kind of wild to me. So wounds that get like really infected for people, mm-hmm. typically it's people who have diabetes. Diabetes can cause like blood vessel damage, especially small blood vessels, which is what mm-hmm. supplies your skin, right? So people will get ulcers in their skin that won't heal because there's not proper blood flow. Oh, okay. So they usually start kind of like on their butt, right? Like it'll start somewhere where there's like high pressure, like your pelvis or whatever is pressing down and cutting off that blood supply. And for people who live a really sedentary lifestyle, they don't get up and move and get that circulation flowing. That tissue becomes ischemic, which basically means it doesn't get blood flow. So it dies and then an ulcer forms. Well, this lady had an ulcer. She gets wheeled into the OR, and all that the resident had told me, like the surgical resident, was like, yeah, we're going to be doing a wound debridement, which is basically where you're cutting off rotten tissue, right? And like Whoa. Cleaning it out. Mm-hmm. And so I go back into the OR, and this patient is like prone on the surgical table, and they just did not have a right butt cheek. Like it was just, there was nothing. It was muscle, fat, and just Whoa. Dead tissue. Holy so we had crap. To go in there and like, we're trying to get sterile and everything, but because of the extensive wound, right? Like if she were to pass a bowel, it goes straight into the wound, right? Oh. Just because of yeah. where it was.
So this is know? Like you shaved all of the like dead or rotten yeah. flesh away. Mm-hmm. And you just have to shave it away.
You have to shave it away. You can't leave it. The thing, yeah, because if you leave it, what happens is it becomes rotten. Bacteria mm-hmm. grow in there, mm-hmm. and the bacteria get into your bloodstream, and you die. Right. There's nothing yeah. you can do about it. Right. You have to cut it out. It won't heal. It won't scar. It will just rot, and you'll go septic, and you'll die. Yeesh. So there is no option. And the only way you know that you're in viable tissue is if it bleeds. So, you know, you get in there, and you're getting around the edge, and you're just cutting, and there's just no blood. And so Whoa. You just, you know, keep cutting back, and then you start cutting and you see some bleeding. And so you take a little electrical cautery thing and you cut that off and you're like, okay, we're good in this region. You know, you just keep going.
So y'all kept going until you realized you're like, oh my God, this keeps just going deeper and deeper and deeper.
Wow. Totally. So the way it went down was like, you could actually see this patient's, colon from the outside.
Damn.
You could see where the anus was, you could see where their rectum was. And then on the front side, it wrapped essentially all the way around their upper leg. You could see the portion of the vagina that should be on the inside, right? Mm-hmm. Like inside the flesh. but you could see the wall of the vagina from the outside.
Oh my Lord.
And whenever you're done debriding it, you have to do it about every other day. Sometimes every day. And when you're done, you have to get like bleach soaked rags and basically just stuff that area and then staple a rag on top of it. Whoa. Because you have to have easy access the next day. You know, you can't close it. And she didn't have enough skin to close it. Essentially, it looked like
there's like not enough skin. You can't gather enough skin.
Exactly. Like, there was not enough skin. Like the way this looks, the best way I could explain it would be that her right leg looked like she was wearing thigh highs of flesh, but then it just stopped. Yeah. And then it was just muscle on top of that because all the fat, all the skin had died and rotted off or was cut off by us. And it had the weirdest smell. That one had a smell.
Oh, man.
Because it was rotten tissue.
It's rotted, yeah.
And I thought it was going to be like smell like, you know, I thought it was going to just smell like, honestly, like shit, right?
Like a carcass or something.
Yeah, you would think. Yeah. It didn't. It smelled like salt and vinegar chips.
Oh,
dang. Oh, man.
And I don't know what that was. Like, I don't know what made it smell that way.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was like the antiseptics that they had been scrubbing on it. But I just remember we had finally like finished it up. And I'm just sitting there and the resident just tosses me this scrub. And it's a scrub that's like one half is a sponge. The other half was like kind of like bristles. And she just goes, get to scrubbing. And I was like, wait, what do we mean? What do we mean when we say get to scrubbing? And she was like, scrub the wound. And I was like, okay. So I like open up this sponge and I get it wet. And like literally we're just like all inside the wound. We had to get up to the edge where the fat was. We had to scrub the muscle. And this foam just becomes pink because it's bleeding a little bit as we're scrubbing it, which is intentional. That's what we're supposed to do.
Agitated.
Yeah, it's getting agitated. It's getting inflamed. So like we're just sitting there scrubbing this wound with this like sterilizing stuff. And I'm just sitting there like, what am I doing with my life? Like somebody over here.
Do you have like when you're dealing with stuff like this, is it like, obviously this isn't an everyday, this maybe something like this happens once a month, once a week. Or
it depends. Stuff like, I mean, for me, on the service, there were several. Now, they're not always this bad. Sometimes they're just ulcers. You know, you get in there, you debride out a little bit, you clean it up, and it's good enough that you could just take a skin graft from the thigh and close it up, and good. Everything's good, right? This one was just so extensive that it was like, there's no graft you can do for this. Like, I mean, I just remember the surgeons being like, we're essentially doing this until this patient passes. Because, like, you can't close that. There was so much missing. Like, there's nothing there. I mean, a lot of the, a lot of medicine is like, sometimes it's saving lives. People come in with an acute issue. They come in with appendicitis. You go and you cut it out. You send them home and they're better for it. Sometimes it's frequent flyers who have heart failure, have kidney disease. They need dialysis or whatever it is. And you're just basically treating their symptoms and you have to send them home knowing they're going to come back.
Right.
Like there's just what it is. Like some people you're just trying to limit the amount of suffering that they're going to have to go through. Until they pass, right? And that's just the reality. And but this was kind of one of those cases, you know. It's just like cleaning it up and doing all this and then just packing it down with those bleach soaked rags and covering it up and basically being saying, you know, see you tomorrow, because we're gonna have to do it again tomorrow.
Does this produce any kind of like adrenaline rush or panic or bouts of fear or like, I don't know. Have you ever had a panic attack?
So for me or for the patient?
For you.
No. I mean, so my very first, the very first surgery I saw, you know, I've always been able to like handle gore. Like you see it on online or you know, someone gets a broken bone and you're like, oh man, that's, you know, that looks bad, whatever. But I could always handle it. But the first procedure I was scrubbing into was a hernia repair in the abdomen. And I was like, okay, like essentially a part of someone's intestines was herniating through a deformity in their abdominal wall, right? Mm-hmm. It's common. It happens a lot. But I just like, I was scrubbed in, I was ready to go. And then like, they were like, okay, we're about to make the incision. And I was just like, oh shit. Like, I hope I can handle this. Like, I hope, like I just assume I'm going to be fine. Yeah. Like,
right,
you know,
right.
And so they make that
cut someone's stomach open.
Right. And I'm like, you're about to go dig around in their guts and just, you know, yank and suture and all this stuff. So I'm just like, I hadn't even really thought, like, what if I can't handle this? which that went away pretty quickly. But those first 5 minutes, I was like, okay, just breathe. You know, this is good. We're good. Yeah, exactly.
Trying to get in.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's just like, I'm not a surgeon. I don't know what I'm doing. Right, this person's going to die. You know, and it's, of course, that wasn't the case. So the first procedure that I did kind of get that little bit of an adrenaline rush and like making sure like, okay, keep your feet steady, move around, don't pass out. Cause that'll look really stupid if like, I'm like, hi, I'm the medical student. I'm here to observe and learn. And you're going to be evaluating me based on my performance. And then you just like fall backwards. And then they're like, oh great, this dumbass couldn't handle it. And they got to go over there and bring me water and a cold rag on my head. Right. You know, like that's the, that I was more afraid of that than the surgery. Right. Yeah. But so, but there are classmates that I have that, like I was in the student room and one of my classmates came in and she was like, I am about to pass out and I feel like I'm going to throw up. And I was like, oh no, are you okay? Like, you know, we're all on surgery together right now. Not the entire class, but a group of us. And, you know, she was just like, I just can't handle it. And I was like, well, what do you mean? Like, was it just a bad procedure? Or was like, did something go on? Was there a complication? And she's like, no, I just can't handle the surgery. So there are some people who like, honestly, it's 6 weeks of hell because, you know, every day you've got to go in and watch people, you know, get sliced open and bleed. And there's a smell. The cautery is what they use to stop bleeding and to like cut through everything but skin, essentially. I don't know if you've ever like caught. So like we have a like an electric fly swatter that you can just like smack. It looks like a tennis racket. If you catch the flies on there and you hold it down and it just burns them, it gives off this like burnt smell. That's exactly what human flesh smells like. So if you've ever smelt a burnt fly.
I know what you're talking about.
That's exactly what it smells like. Oh my gosh. You get used to it eventually.
Yeah.
Unless you're burning through fat. If you burn through fat, no joke, it smells like Fritos.
Really?
Fritos. Exactly like Fritos.
Wait, not just salt and vinegar chips.
And you know what's weird? Like, I'm ashamed to admit this, but there have been times where like I'll smell that and I'm like, ooh, that smells good, and my stomach will rumble. And I'm like, what is going on right now?
When's lunchtime, man?
Well, a lot of times too, I mean, when you're on surgery, it's like the two rules are like eat when you can and don't mess with the pancreas, right? Those are like the two rules of surgery. So there are some times where like you don't eat till 3 p.m. Wow. Right? So sometimes you are starving. You go into there, you smell something that smells like Fritos and just like your stomach's just like, yum, 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 you know, and you're just, it's weird though. It's a very weird feeling.
You're bumping the surgeon next to you. You're like, hey man, you want to go Sonic? Fritos chili pie for this?
Chili pie, please.
It's making me fucking hungry, man. You know what I'm saying?
You get a good fart that smells like cheese and you're like, woo! Yeah, there you go. There Fritos and cheese, baby!
Oh my God. So there's like the gross side of it, but then there's also the much more human, emotional side. Like, have you had difficult emotional... I don't know, because you think about the just becoming a doctor, like all the difficulties of learning the skill and passing the tests and all that. But then there's the other side of it of just being at the front seat of like suffering and death and all of that. And you must have been preparing for that for a while. But like, does that, do you feel like you've taken, I don't know, had any significant impact done to you from any experiences?
It's. That's a good question. Like, it's hard. Like, there are times where I always thought that as I went through medical school and like, as I saw more, like, yeah, I've had to be a part of like delivering the news that like, yeah, your dad has cancer now, or like their cancer has come back. We had one patient who had a pretty like relatively harmless surgery, but as a potential complication that was discussed, you know, this was not malpractice. They had a stroke. And we had to tell them like he's not going to recover.
Oh, like, so it's almost like, oh, you can do the surgery. There's like a 3 or 5% chance of,
and sometimes that happens. Like there's a percent chance, a small percent chance risk because it can happen and it has happened. And these things are always discussed with the patients, but obviously the hope is always you're going to do great. You want it like after every surgery, the surgeon goes and calls whoever the patient put as their like contact, mm-hmm. and they call them in the OR and say, hey, you know, we just finished with, you know, Miss Jones. That's just mm-hmm. a random name. But say, you know, we just finished up. Everything went great. You know, they're going to be put in recovery. They're going to come out from their anesthesia mm-hmm. and, you know, they're going to be hurting a little bit, but we're going to give them some medication. They can go home and, you know, kind of give them the list of like, this is things you need to watch out for. You know, if mm-hmm. she gets a fever, if this and that, and that's the phone call you always want to make, right. you know, but right. there are times where that's not the phone call you get to make. And I always thought that, you know, it would be easier as you got more like exposure to it, that like you'd kind of harden a little mm-hmm. bit. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's been the opposite.
It probably gets harder.
I think eventually it will get, I wouldn't want to say easier, but it'll be easier to cope with.
You think right? you'll hit a balance.
Yeah, I think so. But for now, I always thought like, oh yeah, you know, I'm a year into third year. You know, the first 2 years of medical school, you're in a classroom, you don't deal with a lot of patients. But in the third year, that's like all you do. Mm. And I thought like, oh, by the end of third year, like this will be, I'll have it down on pack. I'll know how to give bad news and how to like kind of console the family and, you know, give them information and things like that. But as you have more exposure to what kind of suffering there is, you mm-hmm. know, like some people, it's like,
yeah.
like with the COVID pandemic, mm-hmm. you know, people are like, oh yeah, so and so they're in the ICU on a ventilator, and you hear that and you think like, you just imagine someone in a bed just laying there and they've just got a tube in their mouth and they're just, oh, but like in reality it's yeah. brutal.
Yeah,
it's brutal. You're people watching
are people like struggling.
There are people who have tubes down in their throat that are vomiting because it's just, you know, mm-hmm. irritating their throats. Mm-hmm. There are people who aren't breathing. There's people who it's like no matter what you adjust the ventilator to, they're not getting oxygen. Ugh. And there's people who are just suffocating, and you see that and you're like, when someone's like, yeah, my, you know, my uncle got COVID and he's in the ICU, everyone pray for him. I'm like, you have that idea. You have the luxury of having that idea of what that looks like, of them just right. laying there getting support. But like I almost have that curse of like, I know what it looks like, right. what they're actually going through. I don't know what they're going through personally because I haven't experienced that. You
can see what's actually going on.
But I know, yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I know almost, like, I could almost predict what's happening to them right now. Mm-hmm. And it's hard because you hear that, and especially when it happens to people you know. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just like, man, like, people aren't supposed to suffer the way that you can see people suffer. Mm-hmm. And so it almost makes it harder because you know what that looks like. And so it's like, you know, you hear about someone who has dementia and they get a UTI and they, you know, have an altered mental status and fell and broke their hip. And you're, you know, in your head, you just expect this like, oh yeah, so-and-so, whatever, no problem. They fell, they'll go to the doctor and the doctor will make it better. But then like, you know what actually, you've seen that progress happen. Like you've mm-hmm. seen people slowly lose their minds. And then you've seen what a broken hip really looks like and how yeah. painful the recovery is. It's not just, oh, they broke it, it'll get better. It's they broke it and this is what they're going to go through before they get better. Mm-hmm. You know, it just doesn't make it just, and I think eventually it will get easier, but just shockingly, like mm-hmm. it hasn't yet for me.
Yeah. I mean, your knowledge, like you said, the knowledge of human suffering is just growing
yeah.
for that position.
Absolutely.
Like, just seeing how the body can be broken and mangled in all these different ways or
yeah.
disease or anything like that. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah. You get a unique perspective into suffering mm-hmm. and it's sad. It's mm-hmm. really sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's almost like too much of a, well, like a stoic practice would be, you know, you meditate on your own death or think of how mm-hmm. you can suffer or think of how people have suffered. And you almost like sprinkle your day with a little bit of that just to give you like gratitude and like mm-hmm. perspective and framing. But then you're almost getting like an overdosage, like every day is your job of yeah. just like mm-hmm. extra human suffering, extra gore, extra violence. And so it's almost unnatural. But I imagine, like I've heard this, that doctors, they kind of just almost split their personalities.
Yeah.
Just out of a defense, but not even like, oh, I'm going to act different, but just like,
yeah.
hey, when I get home, I'm a different person.
Yeah,
right. Because I just want to cleanse my mm-hmm. my time with my family, my identity of everything that I'm doing at work.
Yeah.
And I don't know, like, I don't know if that's like healthy.
No, I think it absolutely is.
Yeah,
I think yeah. that you have to have some way to cope. Like you have mm-hmm. to have this is my mindset when I'm here. But you can't bring that mindset home, or you're cold and you're like unopened and like you can't. I can't be the dad that my son deserves for me to be if I'm being cold and emotionless. Right. I'm not saying in medicine you have to be cold and emotionless, but
you have to position yourself and be in a stance to where you can like not be affected by it.
Very often. You're dealing with emotional situations where the people on the other side are going to be completely emotional because it's, you know,
exactly
their loved one or themselves.
Yeah.
Or
and it would be a poor practice to not sympathize with them, but you just can't bring that burden home with you.
Right.
So you have to have this switch in your head. That's like, okay, I'm in the hospital. I can be emotionally invested in this. I can be there for these patients. I can have compassion for this, but you can't bring that home.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to, you absolutely have to have a different mindset, a different way of processing things when you come home, because yeah, you'll be shut off. I think that's a great talent that I don't think that you really learn how to do until you're a little further into your career.
I was just about to say, I've noticed like the older I've gotten and the more frequent doctor visits I go to, or I've had like a family physician who is like an older doctor, you can kind of tell almost like if you can pick up on people's personalities, at least I've been able to tell some doctors, I'm like, oh, you don't act this way at home. Like,
yeah.
The way they talk to you, the way that they make you like approach you, they make you feel comfortable, but like at the same time, they're prepared.
It's very automated.
Yeah. And I notice that a lot with older doctors. So, I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, the longer you do it, the easier it gets.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And there's like a stereotype of like the grouchy old doctor who's like super traumatized and all that. But like, honestly, I haven't met that many doctors, and the ones I have are all older, and they're all super nice and usually a joy to be around.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's clearly like, okay, they're meant to do this. Like they got this down. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are certainly those people though, who got into medical school a long time ago when it was a little bit easier to get into, where they weren't thinking as much about like the way that they, because I mean, physicians are not flawless. Like physicians are people. It's a job. You know what I mean? Right. It's not an identity. It's a job.
Right.
And, not everyone's perfect. So you do get, you know, you do get a few bad apples.
Mm-hmm.
You see them in the news and whatever. But that's kind of why the whole approach into like admissions in medical school has a lot more to do with like, Landon would probably be into this, but like behavior analysis, you know, like trying to figure out like, will you be a good person? Like, will you be a good physician? Will you be compassionate? You know, are you going to be one of those people? Are you going to be one of those surgeons who throw equipment across the room and scream and cuss at their staff? Or are you going to be someone who's compassionate and a good teacher and, you know, things like that?
Yeah.
But yeah. Some.
I definitely want someone doing a surgery on me to be very pleasant and soft-spoken.
Yeah.
Not throwing things.
Absolutely.
Accidentally dropping stuff into me.
Yeah, like how would you feel if you're just like about to have surgery and you like overhear your doctor?
Yeah.
He's like, the divorce is going terrible.
Yeah.
All right, let's cut you open. Like just... Yeah.
You know, it's tough to put down the bottle. Okay, let's go.
Yeah.
I've heard are you still high?
Yeah. I was petrified when I had a surgery going because they wheeled me into that room and I could see all the nurses and do they usually do that? Are people usually awake when they take you into the room? Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if I was like got unlucky that day and I was like, no, am I supposed to be seeing all this?
Yeah. Right, one of the reasons is because you got to like transition onto the bed, operating bed, which you can do when patients are unconscious. It's not unheard of. Like it's pretty common too that people will come in already sedated.
Okay.
But depending on the procedure, you know, they'll just bring them in there and they'll say, you know, we're going to put, it's kind of done in phases. They'll give them like some, what's called like Versed, which is kind of like Xanax, kind of has like a similar effect and it just kind of mellows you out, calms you down. And then they'll put something that actually puts you under sedation. So they're really good about it and they take care of people as they're going in and they make sure not to touch them until they're out. Like you don't want them to, you know, have that, like my eyes are closed, but I can feel that, you know?
Okay. That was actually something I wanted to ask about. Like, it's a hypochondriac thing because I know this is like a super small probability event, but like, I think about it a disproportional amount of time is like the people that have the anesthesia experiences or whatever, where they still feel their body. Like what is that phenomenon?
You know,
and how often does it happen? Like have
it
you heard?
It doesn't happen often. Okay. So different people have different like enzymes or enzyme concentrations in their body. Some people metabolize anesthesia quicker than others. Mm. And it's actually like some people, you can't give them sedation because their body does it so slowly that they will just stay sedated for a long time. Yeah. But then other people, you give them a pretty decent amount, like enough that would like knock out a mule, right? Mm-hmm. And they're just still sitting there. So there's this balance. That's why there's anesthesiologists. And it's like basically their job to monitor vitals, look at the patient. Like literally anesthesiologists are at the head of the surgery bed and they can see the patient's face. Wow. And so they just sit there. And if they start moving and wrestling around, that's when they'll go in and they'll fix things, right?
Just
and they'll
like just flick them out of the nose.
Yeah, right. But like they literally have got like all the drugs they need and they can just inject it, keep them under.
Interesting.
And so it's like a fine balance of that. Usually when people sometimes do like wake up a little bit from surgery, but typically they're still so sedated, they can't feel it and they don't remember it. Oh, right.
That's wild.
Yeah. So like someone will just kind of moving around and the surgeon will be like, hey, I think they're kind of coming to a little bit. Let's give them something. The anesthesiologist will just do it and it's no harm. And they don't wake up and scream and moan because they can just feel it. Mm-hmm. You know, normally there's so many.
That's incredible. That's an incredible like picture to think about of a human body being open. Mm-hmm. And then they're just kind of slowly like waking up. Yeah. And it's like, just flip a switch, give them more. And then they're.
Exactly. Well, and it's like, because you could, I mean, when you think about it, it's got to be a balance, right? You don't mm-hmm. want to sedate someone so heavily that they stop breathing.
Right.
And a lot of sedation can actually, like, especially with like opioids, morphine, things like mm-hmm. that can, slow down your bowel. Right. So you can mm-hmm. actually get like what's called post-op ileus. And it's just mm-hmm. basically where your intestines are paralyzed.
Mm.
And it's like that can cause obstructions, that can cause swelling, that can cause perforation, and that can cause another need for a surgery. Mm. So it's this fine balance of like making sure they're sedated enough that they're not going to experience any discomfort or any pain, mm-hmm. But also making sure that you're not doing it so much that you're going to cause more complications.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why you need a good anesthesiologist.
Yeah.
So no, I mean, the only time I have done, or I didn't do the operation, it was part of the operation, that was done on someone who was consciously sedated. So they're awake, but you give them a nerve block. For them, they had to have a dialysis port put in their arm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, every nerve that goes through your arm runs through a bundle of nerves here in your armpit. So you can essentially just inject what's called a nerve block in that makes it so that they can't feel anything.
Wow.
Right. So they're completely awake, completely aware, but they just can't feel that you're making incisions and pulling around on blood vessels and making all these things and you're messing with nerves and all the stuff. They just can't feel it. And it's good for them because, you know, there's a lot of complications that can happen when you're sedated and you're not taking deep breaths. You know, you can mm-hmm. get pneumonia and there's other things that can happen. So sometimes when they can be conscious, that's what they'll prefer that because mm-hmm. just leads to better outcomes and better healing. So mm-hmm.
is the human body, I'm assuming the human body is similar to the human mind where they're all different. So I guess they all would react differently to certain medicines or all of that. But I mean, is there any type of, I guess you were talking about how before you can kind of tell a situation, you know, like what's going on. I mean, is the human mind kind of similar to the human body with this where like, I guess certain patients just need certain things more than other ones.
Yeah, absolutely. And the surgeon that's actually leading our clerkship right now is trying to get research done on like pre-op, like cognitive fitness testing, right? To like mm-hmm. make sure that they understand what's going on, why it's needed,
mm-hmm.
and kind of, you know, boosting them up and being like, you know, you're going to do well. You are going to recover well, you know, like just do these things that we're asking of you and you're going to have a better turnout.
Mm.
And so like mentally, yeah, like everybody's different. Some people need to hear different things and, mm-hmm. and some people will do better in the post-op period because they had, you know, certain like education about what mm-hmm. it's going to be and what it's going to be like. And some people who are, you know, like cognitively impaired mm-hmm. and have like, you know, mental functioning problems typically don't do as well post-op.
Right.
You know, so yeah, I mean, the mind is also absolutely intertwined with the body and with healing. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, it's very important to, and everyone's different. I mean, like mm-hmm. I said, so, you know, whether or not they respond to certain medications has more to do with like enzyme levels and sometimes their mm-hmm. liver or something like that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, mentally and cognitively, there's a pretty big association that's being studied on like post-op outcomes healing. Yeah. Cool. Based on their cognitive assessments and stuff. So yeah, definitely.
It's kind of one of those timeless things that doesn't need medical advice. Like you don't need a doctor to tell you this, like have a good mindset, be mm-hmm. confident, stand mm-hmm. up straight. Like these things, they are so old and they have such a natural effect on everything.
Dude, I started doing that. Standing up straight. Yeah. Like, it's yeah. crazy.
Or just like noticing, trying to notice your posture.
Yeah, like it's insane the amount of like a confidence. At least I would get very small, like just doing that. Like
yeah.
Reminding yourself like, hey, like almost puff your chest out. Like,
yeah, totally.
It helps.
It makes you feel better. You don't feel like a grouch, like you're slouching around. Mm. Like mm. you feel more confident. Like there's so much. There's so much power in just like those little things you can mm-hmm. do mm-hmm. and ways you can change the way that you think, mm-hmm. you know, like rather than focusing on your negatives, like mm-hmm. focus on what you're good at and like mm-hmm. hype yourself up, hype other people up, making other people feel good about themselves makes you feel good, mm-hmm. stand tall, you know, things like that. It's yeah. crazy. Mm-hmm. Like what it can actually do for you.
There's mm-hmm. lots of selfish reasons to do things that would be, maybe at a surface level, considered virtuous.
Yeah.
But it's actually like, no, I'm just being selfish. I'm being long-term selfish.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think about that. Like something, especially going through the job search for me, something that immensely helped is changing my body's state, like mm-hmm. on purpose. And I had probably had to hear this 100 times before I really utilized it, but if I'm nervous before an interview and I'm shaky, I would go and I would do jumping jacks in the living room.
Yeah.
And like to the point to where I was like starting to gasp, my body would be in a different state. My blood would be pumping fast. I'd yeah. feel different. Or if I was feeling bad, depressed, you mm. know, applied to 100 jobs and got yeah. rejected.
Yeah.
And it's another fucking day. And like one of the, like sometimes I would just get up and go in the living room and do jumping jacks, as stupid as it is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it's not.
And it's not. And like after 2.5, 3 minutes, you know, I'm get distracted, think of something else. And then I'll stop and I'll realize like, I'm not sad anymore.
Yeah.
I can't identify a solid reason on why I should pick up being sad again.
Yeah.
And you kind of just see through the veil of all of that. And you realize that most of the time my emotions, why I'm feeling bad is... maybe it's most of the time for some people it's different for every person, but I've noticed that like most of the time it's the state of my body, or like the state of my mindset, my yeah. framing, like what types of thoughts are going through my head.
Yeah.
And once again, like I guess adults tell us stuff like that, but they don't say it in such like simple terms, like, like, hey, you're happy because you're, you know, like your blood's not flowing. Mm-hmm. And you've been inside. You yeah. need the sun and you need your blood to flow faster, mm-hmm. and that'll make you yeah. happier. Like if someone would have told me that when I was 4. It's more like,
go outside. Get outside.
But yeah, yeah, they tell you that and you're like, no, I don't want to fucking get outside. Yeah. You know?
Like, there's not just video games outside. You just want me
to get away. Yeah.
No, but that's... So like the head surgeon for my clerkship, he literally got a group of us and like put us into a cognitive fitness group, right? And that was one of the first things he mm. talked about, and I thought it was so cool. He was talking about like what you're talking about. You kind of get panicked, your heart races, your blood pressure raises.
Oh, yeah.
What that all comes down to from an evolutionary standpoint is a mm. perceived threat. Mm-hmm. You perceive a threat and your body is telling you you're about to be eaten by a bear or whatever,
the fight or flight.
Yes. Thing. And that's your yeah. body's natural like response to like a perceived threat. You got to have increased blood flow to your muscles because you're about to have to fight for your life. Mm. You need to, your eyes dilate because you're about to have to see every fine detail. Like there's so many things that go on, but in reality, it's not a threat. You're not about to die. Mm. You don't need that stuff going on. So having an awareness of that and practicing like challenging yourself, like, okay, I feel anxious. I feel nervous. Like this feels like a threat, but I need to see how I can like basically push through this and perform and challenge myself and challenge that initial, like, that threat that you feel like you're feeling, which you are feeling. It feels like a threat, right? Because mm-hmm. you're like, it does matter. That's not to say it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But physically, it's not a threat. You're not about to die, mm-hmm. right? But that's what your body thinks. And so challenging that mentality and practicing performing under stress can really help the way that you respond to future events that cause stress. And so I thought it was fascinating because, like, I had to go do an OSCE, which I don't know what it stands for, but it's a test we have to do. It's a test we have to do in our clerkships. And it's basically where they take, like, standardized patients, which are like paid actors who will act like they have a certain illness.
Okay.
Right. And so we have to go in there. They have a certain illness in their mind that they know that they're supposed to pretend like they have. They have all the details of all the stuff we're supposed to ask them that they know. And they want us to go in there and they want us to ask them, you know, what's your name? How old are you? What brings you in? Why does that, you know, concern you? When did it start? You know, and you got to ask all these questions. You got to get their medical history, their family history, their social history, where they work, if they do drugs, if they smoke, if they drink. I mean, you got to get all this information, and you got 15 minutes to do all that and a physical exam. 15 minutes. Then you got to go out in the hallway and you've got 10 minutes to write a complete note on everything that you just absorbed. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, that makes up a quarter of our grade in the 6 week clerkship.
Wow.
And so this guy was like, this test is important. You're going to get in there and you're going to get jittery and you're going to feel anxious, but it's not a threat. He was like, use this as an opportunity to practice. Like, he was like, be a cognitive ninja, challenge your body. Tell yourself mentally, this is not a threat. This is a test that I'm taking for a grade.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to die. This patient's not going to die. Mm-hmm. Everything is going to be fine. And let's just perform.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say I didn't do really shitty on that OSCE. But my mind, like, I was in a better place. Like, like, I did first get that set of like, ooh, okay, this, oh man, this is going to be bad, you know, whatever. But, like, I challenged my mind. And so that's something that, like, definitely can help a lot of people, just mindfulness and being aware of, is this really something, like, not something that you shouldn't take seriously, but is this really a threat? Is this really going to affect my life in such a serious way? And then sometimes it will, you know, like, you're like a job interview for a job that could potentially change your life. That is stressful, and you can't just not be anxious.
Right.
But it does help to have that awareness of, I am okay. Mm-hmm. Even if this goes the worst way possible, I will still be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and that just challenging your mind and reframing your thought process. There's a lot of value in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And most of, like, all of that echoes something for me that I've really felt strongly lately, that most of happiness, or most of, like, most of the way to happiness, whatever that is, which everyone disagrees and has their own ideas.
Yeah.
But most of that, that what we're looking for is actually less pain. Like,
yeah,
the 20% you can do that makes up for the 80% of, like, a happy, well-maintained person is just take away negatives, reduce negatives, and doing something like purposeful, gradual exposure to pain and suffering and stress is a way that you can just make things less stressful for the rest of your life. And it's the same thing with, like, meditating, which is something, mindfulness meditation, which is something that I'm specifically into, is, like, you, it teaches you how to frame or how to take a step back or have a meta look at your own emotions and feel them just in a particular way that's detached from the story that you're telling yourself. This gives you the insight that, like, wow, most of the pain of suffering, or the suffering and pain, is actually in the story I'm telling myself, the narrative, the mindset. And for me, like, putting that into practice, I mean, when I when I recently, you know, last week jumped over a creek and
I didn't know if you wanted to bring that up. I wasn't going to bring it up.
I mean, you know, it's whatever. It's what I'm dealing with right now. But hanging out,
pretty sick jump though.
You know, well, it's actually funny now. If it's not the most Oklahoma sounding thing, that, like, oh, how'd you hurt your knee? Yeah. Like, oh, I'm at my friend's farm in some knee high mud boots, and I jumped over a creek.
Jumped over the creek.
Yeah, jumped over the creek.
Chasing a crawl dad.
But yeah, that's what happened. You know, I did. And as soon as I landed, you know, pop, twist, I fell to the ground, instant, just terrible pain. And I instantly broke out into a sweat. And I don't know, like I just, I felt my meditation practice in that moment. Cause like there was an initial rise of like panic and just primal fear. And then I was like, wait, I don't even know what it wasn't like, oh, I'm going to be fine. Everything's okay. Yeah. Like I still thought something might be wrong.
Right.
But it was more just like, I'm okay. I can be a part of me can be detached from this. Like this is now happening. I know I can accept this. Just have to take it moment by moment. Yep. And just, I really felt that come into play. And then most of the suffering that I felt of this injury has been the moments that I was panicking later the day or the next day when like it hurt a little bit and I was uncertain and I was like scared and remembering what happened or whatever, like that's actually most of the pain. And so that's just a huge point of signal for me that I've tuned into lately.
I kind of like reading and listening to like Navy SEALs talk about that concept too, of like just putting yourself in a situation that is completely painful, but like mentally knowing how to keep that heart rate down and like breathing practices and going to a meditative state when things get elevated to keep you just focused on what you're doing.
Yeah. Talk about cognitive fitness. You're going to see it in those guys and ladies.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, like, this is why it really distresses me, a lot of the advice or perspectives or a mindset or lingo that's going around about just how we are ever more encouraged to focus on our disadvantages and, like, focus on where we are oppressed or where we are victimized or anything like that. And I know this is, like, a hot take that, that people express. And maybe people don't want to hear it, but like, I think it's just blaringly obvious that for many individuals and especially young kids in school, that this is being pointed out and that it makes you suffer more. Like that's all it really does. Like you're training people to suffer more because you're training them to develop and focus on the narratives around the pain and negatives and disadvantages in their life. And that is exactly a recipe to have someone suffer, no matter what position they're in or what benefits they have in life, you know. And I think that stands in opposition to gratitude and humility, which are just classic virtues that I think are selfish. I think that you should selfishly have those because it reduces your suffering and makes you enjoy the things that you have more.
It could put you in a position to help other people not suffer as much either.
Exactly. A lot of times when you're hurting people, you're acting out of like, a short-term selfishness or a reaction to something. And
Be better to be long-term selfish and help them.
Yeah,
that's kind of an interesting way to think about
it. I need to coin that phrase now. Long term selfish. I'm sure someone else has done it, but it's huge sidetrack there. But I mean, you know, mindset and your state of mind, like, it has everything to do with your body and your health. And you know, this actually brings me back to something I think about a lot. Like you're talking about these patients that come in and out kind of on rotation. Like what percentage of the patients you see do you feel like kind of fall into this category?
I mean, honestly, a lot of them.
Like 50%?
It depends on the service you're on. So with surgery, for the most part, you know, someone comes in and they've got like their gallbladder and it needs to be removed. I mean, they're not going to... Okay, it's not impossible, but they're not going to come back likely with gallbladder problems. And sometimes those are people who are in their 30s who otherwise are healthy and they just need a quick fix, right? They just get in there, give them the surgery, and they're good to go. But like when I was on neuro, so that neurology, that one, you see some of the sickest patients. You'll see people who have like degenerative nerve disease.
Right.
Like, those are the type of people, like that's the service you would see people with like ALS, right?
Yeah.
Or you see people with like super severe, like there's something called like Huntington's disease, and it's just where people just slowly lose their mind and they lose their ability to function. And You'll see people who are paralyzed from a gunshot wound, and you know, like, so those types of people, I mean, they'll have some kind of issue with their brain. They'll have some kind of stroke. They can't protect their airway, right? So they are eating food and they aspirate a little bit of food, and then they get pneumonia, and they're going to come in and they're going to need to be fixed, and you're going to fix it. You're going to give them medication. Their lungs are going to get better. And you're going to send them home, and then inevitably it's going to happen again. So on surgery, I would say you're not going to see a lot of frequent flyers there, because a lot of the times they're there for an acute issue that you can just fix, right?
Okay.
But like on internal medicine, you'll see patients, you know, you'll say, you know, I've got this patient, so-and-so just came in. And the residents will be like, oh yeah, we know them. You know, they're a frequent flyer. That's what they call them. You know, because they're just, they come in, you know, your heart starts failing, right? You can't pump blood efficiently throughout the body. Fluid leaks out of your blood vessels, builds up in your legs, it builds up in your lungs. The only treatment really is, besides having a better heart, is giving them, you know, which is called diuretics, and a lot of people call them water pills. Basically just resorbs all that fluid. And you pee it out, right? But you have to have a prescription or at least see a doctor for it. But a lot of times people come in because they can't breathe. So, you know, give them Lasix, which is what the term for that water pill is. They pee it off. They can breathe better. And you send them home. But
they know it's going to happen
again. But their heart's still bad. And it's just going to happen again, right?
Yeah.
So you see a lot of that. Sometimes you'll see people who on internal medicine, which is ultimately the field that I'll probably be going into, that or radiology. But on internal medicine, you know, someone will be post-op day three. The surgery team doesn't need to keep seeing them, so they'll admit them to the medicine team just to make sure they don't have any, like, issues with, you know, any of their recovery or anything like that, or any of their other issues they've been diagnosed with. And then, you know, you see them, you send them home, and you may never see them again. But it's, yeah, it's all too frequent, you know, how often you will see people come in and out. I mean, I was only on internal medicine for 6 weeks, and there was one patient that within those 6 weeks I had seen come back to the hospital three times. So that's essentially every 2 weeks. Not to mention that when they do come back, they spend a good 2 or 3, 4 days in the hospital and then are discharged and are back, you know, within that same 2 week frame.
What a life.
So it's like, man, they just, and it's like not a lot you can do.
Right.
You know, it's just, as a medical professional, it's just your job to make sure that they suffer the least as possible. You know? You want to, like, help them out as much as you can. But at some point, there's nothing you can do but just basically essentially prolong the inevitable. But yeah, you'll see a lot of frequent flyers for sure. That's why people who, like, who do, like, want to go into dermatology, which is, like, the skin. You know, a lot of people want to do that because you can help people in a really meaningful way, but you're also not dealing with the sickest of the sick. You know, you're recurring. someone's got psoriasis and you're like, hey, I've got the treatment for that. And it, like, people who have, like, skin diseases, they wear their disease on their sleeve every day. Everyone sees them. And then you can offer them the option and the treatment plan that, like, gives them all their confidence back.
And they're super stoked, I bet, too.
Like, it's and they're like, experience. You gave me my life back, you know? And so that, that gratitude and that reward, and very, very rarely is there,
complications
that are serious. You know, I mean, there are issues that can happen with the skin. I'm not saying that dermatologists live a risk-free life. But the rewards are so big and the risks are relatively small.
As opposed to having to work in, like, with cancer patients or something. Like,
Where, like, the wins can be big, but the losses can be huge. You know, you've really invested in someone and you've done your best to promise them that you can make them better, and then you know, sometimes you just lose. It's, you know, that's rough. But
yeah,
I love the questions though. Whatever questions you guys have, I'm like, I'm an open book and I'm not offended by any questions. So I mean, anything you've ever been curious about, I'm happy to answer.
We would love to have you back on too, to just at, like, in the future when you have the time, and maybe even after you get done with schooling.
For sure.
Oh, this has been perfect. I mean, you texted me whatever a few months ago, and we're like, hey, I'm going to be off after my surgery rotation for a few weeks. And we, like, consistent, you know, of course we hung out all the time throughout high school and kind of maybe early in the college years, but basically since you've started college, we've seen each other like once a year.
Yeah, at least.
But it's cool because we always, I don't know, get back together and it's like no time has passed. And that's, I don't know, those are some of the best friendships. And, like, the type of people I want to keep around and keep in touch with
for when sure
when I move, which we're not talking about yet.
good friends are hard to come by. Like, it's so true. Yeah. Like, good friends that you could just, like, you know, you'll be friends forever. Like, this could be the last time we see each other until we're 40. And I feel like when we saw each other at 40, I'd just be like, dude, like, what's up?
Yeah.
Like, you have those friendships, you know, where it's just like, you'll always be friends. And so it's hard to, and it's so hard to come by those as you get older. Adulthood just really rips away that spontaneous spark that you have when you're in high school and your ability and your free time. It's wild.
Well, and it's crazy. I've especially the last 2 years, and I think COVID accelerated this, in your mid-20s age, and this is almost the air about the show, is kind of just like how you seem to be really stripped of a lot of your youthful vigor and your friendships and the excitement in your friendships. And, you know, actually something I want to talk about like soon is like adult friendships and like, cause that's a weird, cause you even say that and like it, people think you said like panties or something like it just hits people wrong. They're like, what? You're not, what do you
mean? That's like that was the perfect like comparison I think I've heard in a long time.
No, yeah, exactly. It's just like one of those like,
it made me feel weird for don't a second, say that. And it shouldn't, but
yeah, there's something weird about the word panty.
Yeah, it's just like biting a napkin. But God, I lost my goddamn train of thought. Oh yeah, you know, it's just life just strips you. I don't think it's life. I think it's a lot of the institutions around us and conspiracies and all that. But you know, like you lose so much. You lose like 80% of your friends. The friends that you have, like, they're suffering. Like, people are just like, it's looking bleak. When I look at like the 500 or 250 people, however many it was, that I would interact with and were acquaintances with, like in high school and like early 20s, like of that people, you do a survey of that group and it's looking bleak. It's a, it's a cemetery. It's, you know, like people have gone out into the world and really they've either suffered a lot, a few make it through into something like, oh, I didn't expect that. And then a lot of them are just like, oh, so you really been stuck in whatever kind of, I don't know, place or vice or
lifestyle. Everyone eventually just becomes the general public. That's like how it,
that's
how
a good way to put that. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you're just like,
you slowly morph into the general public.
Yeah. To other people.
Yeah.
You know? And 10 years ago you were something to someone, and then it's just, it's just kind of,
you're just another friend suggestion on Facebook.
Yeah. No, exactly. And I'm like, I don't know, part of me, I'm always trying to rebel against things. And that's a force I've really felt. And I've kind of had to lean into it to, I don't know, learn how to program or like do some of what I've done the past few years. But I'm also like, I don't know, I'm starting to have crazy ideas and try and think of ways to, not fall in that category, like have deeper interactions with my friends, be intentional about like the friendships I want to maintain, but also meeting new people, and like starting new friendships in adulthood, which is like a strange thing that no one talks about. And I don't know, but we'll save that for another time. But you know, I think Caleb, you're just an interesting example. You know, like you can have people that you see every week almost, or every 2 weeks, and you'll be really shallow with each other. You'll realize that like, we're not going to be friends in a few years. But then you can have other people, you know, you see once a year and you just know that like, there's a mutual assurance there and understanding that you're both like, I see you as who you are and I really appreciate you out of the world and want to keep you in contact. That's cool. And like, there's a lot of people worthy of that, but what you're just served up from life, from where you're born, is like a lot of bad apples come along with it and contributes to a lot of people's suffering. I don't know. I'm trying to think of what crazy medical questions I have.
Yeah. I mean, I remember before I went to medical school, I was like, I've always been curious about this. Like, what, even if it's like, what is life like? Or, you know, well, what's the craziest or grossest thing you've seen or whatever? You know, like, there's just times where you just like, you get an itching, but you're like, oh, I don't know if it would be weird to ask that. I'm a pretty open book. So,
I mean, is there something that you've been like, okay, that's the grossest thing I've ever seen?
Well, I mean,
I feel like the story, one of the stories you already told.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. That another really gross one, though. I definitely, I was working in the ER. That was one of my rotations, which cool. That's a cool place to be at the peak of COVID. But I was there, and some dude, like a homeless man, came in off the street, and he was like, "I've got this pain in my butthole," and I was like, "Oh." I guess I can take a look at that for you.
And you just look around. You look around. You're like, there's no one else. You're like, all right.
Yeah, you're like, I don't know where the doctors are. I was like, I'm a medical student, so, you know, take that with a grain of salt. Right. So he just, like, drops his trousers, and I was like, spread them cheeks, boy. He did. There was just this giant bulge right next to the anus. And I was like, that's an abscess. So it was a perianal abscess. And so I was like, I need to go get the doctor and we'll come back and we'll see what we can do about
this. Don't move around too much.
So,
don't do any TikTok dances while I'm gone.
For sure. For sure. So we go and we get the guy, we get the attending, the ER doc. And so basically what he had me do is put on these very thin nitrile gloves and just spread this dude's butt cheeks aside with my own hand.
Dang.
And he had to take a scalpel and just lance the abscess and drain it. And when I tell you, like, the smell. So, like, the same bacteria that caused the abscess is the same bacteria that caused poop to stink, right? But these have just been marinating in this abscess for months. Like, abscesses don't just come overnight.
Yeah.
This one's just been here for a while and it's just gotten bigger. So he just lances it, and then just like this gray brown chunky pus just comes like oozing out, and it's like getting on my finger, but I have gloves on, right? And I'm just like, oh, this is nasty. Like, and the smell, like, it took everything not to gag. Like, it was the worst smell I've ever smelled.
Oh, easily. My gosh.
And so we're doing it. We're letting it drain. He's putting pressure on it. And, like, chunks are coming out. And it's just, like, the other... So I'm just, like, with my other hand, I had to get gauze and just wipe this pus off this homeless dude's butthole. And I was like, that is so... Like, but you have to be professional. You can't be like, well, this is really gross. Like, and, like, gag. Like, the patient's right there and they can hear you.
That would be crazy.
Yeah.
If the medical... like, in a other universe, that everyone in the hospital is just like, oh, that's disgusting.
Yeah, everyone's just, like, real as fuck.
Everyone just, like, pokes their head out through him. Guys, get a load of this guy's ass. You know, so... So I'm, like, trying to maintain, like, professionalism and everything. And so I'm going through all of it or whatever. So it's all done. We wipe it up, everything, put some like liquid bondage over it. Cause you're not going to like, it was a small incision. It didn't need stitches. It just needed a place to come out. So put like a little bit of what they call Dermabond on it just to kind of close it up and keep it. It's basically glue. So it's all done. And then I go to like take my gloves off and there was a hole in my glove. So I was just sitting there just spreading this homeless dude's butt cheeks
thinking away. Hey, good thing I have gloves
at least on. I've got gloves on. Yeah. And meanwhile I'm making skin to skin contact with this dude's beehole. And so I definitely went and like scrubbed my hands. At first I checked, I was like, do I have any cuts on my hand? Because like, you never know. Yeah. You never know what people have. This guy was he was a really nice guy. Like he just had a problem. I don't judge him.
Right.
I have no idea what types of hardships he's gone through. So I don't judge him. It's not his fault that this happened to him.
Right.
But within a population that's medically underserved, like homeless people, you know, there's a lot of hepatitis, there's a lot of HIV, there's a lot of like, you know, can be even tuberculosis, things like that. So of course all those things are going through my head and I'm like, do I have any cuts on my fingers and everything? And so I just went and just like scrubbed my hands for like,
that would keep me up.
Yeah.
That would keep me up for a while.
Bro, I learned this from the restaurant business. Okay. You can double glove up. Okay. I highly suggest it when you have to clean out the grease trap, you know, throw on an extra pair of gloves. I don't know. That seems like an equivalent, dirty task.
Yeah.
But
I think the only other question I have, which is a minor one, is are all of our organs and stuff the same color? Or do
that's
people?
That's a good question.
That people, is a good
do
question.
Do people have like different colors? Like, aren't they just kind of like gray and maybe purplish?
Okay. Red? Okay. Also, but wait, is fat yellow or white?
Fat is yellow.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If fat is white, it has lost blood supply and it's going to rot away.
And they got to scrape it off.
Mm-hmm. And then right? I'll have to cut it out. You'll have to have some third-year medical student go around slicing and dicing in your in your wounds. But that is actually a great question. So different organs are, they typically hover within the same color range. So like your intestines are pink, right? Mm. If they're inflamed, they'll be extra red, like right? They'll be more like a reddish pink. Mm-hmm. If you have like, some people can have like stenosis, which is like a narrowing of the blood vessels that go to the intestines. If those, and they're not getting proper blood supply, they'll get a little more pale. So you'll see kind of like a whitish, light pink type thing. So it kind of
depends on the blood flow, maybe?
Depends on the blood flow and like the organ. So like the liver is probably the one you would get like the most variation in. So someone who's got like fatty liver disease, their liver's going to look a lot more like kind of pale, kind of yellowish, not so much that pinkish and somewhat greenish that you'll see. But then people who have like really bad fibrosis of their liver, they'll get like this connective tissue overgrowth of their liver and it'll almost look shiny.
Wow.
Which is weird. Yeah. And then same with the gallbladder. So like the gallbladder, you can always tell, like, you go in through, like, laparoscopically, and you're looking with the camera, and it's like, it is not hard to find the gallbladder, because the gallbladder is almost blue. It's like this bluish-gray hue that looks like it has, like, a silver lining around it, and it's just, like, usually this tense thing, because typically, if you're going to see the gallbladder, you're going to be there to remove it, because it's dilated, and it's needs to be cut out.
Okay.
So yeah, sometimes you'll see like perfectly healthy looking gallbladders, which are these little green looking pouches. Sometimes they look silver and blue and swollen and all these problems. And then sometimes they look red because they've got so much inflammation. So it really just, it does depend a lot. But like if right now in a healthy state, if you were to look at my liver, your liver and Austin's liver, like all together, they would probably be about the same color.
Gotcha.
Sure. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Damn. Okay. I actually have big. I love asking like the dumbest questions.
Let's hear it.
I'm 26, mostly healthy except for my knee. like what is just like the dumb idiot thing I should just do to avoid the most possibility for like midlife medical problem or just like any kind of medical problems? Is it just like avoiding heart disease? I mean, people say heart disease is the biggest killer, or like diabetes, is it heart disease?
Yeah, heart disease is like the number one killer.
It's just the dumb, the just world. Like, hey, just check this box at least.
Yeah, so like the thing that really makes the difference, you can tell the difference in people who are going to do well and live long and people who aren't, just from looking at them and listening to like what their lifestyle looks like. So people who just regularly exercise, and that doesn't mean like strenuous 2 hours of cardio, it's a total of like 150 minutes of cardio a week. And even then, that's like, that can count like mowing your yard. That counts. That counts as.
Yeah. So that's like half an hour. Yeah. Half an hour every day on the weekdays.
Yes.
If you don't even do anything.
Half an hour a day, 5 days a week of just walk around your block, get up and move, do something. Because the people who get heart failure, some people it's genetic, some people it's drug abuse, it's alcohol abuse.
But you can't help. Well, I guess there's always like the genetic. There's always random chance the metaphorical bus coming your way.
Yes.
Like, that's stuff you can't protect against. But then there's other stuff where you can just be like, oh, I can just put the chips on my side, basically.
Absolutely. And mindfulness. Like, people who are just thinking about their health and making better decisions, just being like, oh, you know, maybe I don't need a large fry, you know, maybe I'll just do a small, and maybe I'll do a single burger instead of a triple, or little things like that, just being mindful and trying to exercise. I mean, there are going to be those people who've smoked 2 packs a day since they were 12 and are now in their 80s, and they're going to live to be 110, right? That's just, some people just win the genetic lottery.
Yeah. My grandpa dipped since he was like 10 and like lived to be like 90, 96, and the thing that killed him was a broken hip.
There you go.
Falling out of a truck.
Like
that was the thing that got him.
It yeah.
was wild.
Just good genetics.
You know, the day that he died was like putting dips in his lip. It's just no dental, not no dental problem, but He didn't develop cancer or anything like that. Yeah. Which was crazy.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, yeah, but like, just people just get up and move, be mindful of what you're eating. And those two things are going to be like the biggest thing. And go to the doctor if you're feeling sick.
Mm-hmm.
If something weird's going on, if you get like a bulge on your neck.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, don't just be like, oh, we'll just see what happens.
Or
like,
a tummy ache that doesn't go away.
Yeah.
Or
like, yeah. If you just got like this gnawing pain in your stomach that you've been feeling for a few weeks, like, just go get it checked out. Like, the best, worst case scenario, you find out it's benign. I mean, that's not the worst case scenario, but like, for a lot of people, the most common thing would be that you'll just find out it was benign and you just wasted a little bit of time and a little bit of money, given that you have insurance.
Right.
But then, you know, sometimes you can catch cancer at a early stage and the only thing you got to do is cut it out.
Yeah.
And then you're
good.
Nip it in the bud, and then it's not going to be a problem. It's not going to be this thing. Cause like I saw someone who, as a matter of fact, I told you guys about like the woman I had, we did the colostomy on, you know, she had breast cancer, kidney cancer, and colon cancer. And it had essentially just spread all over her body. Like, you could put your hand on her abdomen and just push down and feel tumors.
Ooh.
And so it was like, there's nothing you can do. But if you could have caught that sooner, you know, at an earlier stage before it had metastasized all over her body, you know, then in those cases you're good. So it's just being mindful, do some exercise.
And talking about, and of course that's exactly the advice I knew I would hear, but it was like, I wanted to hear how you would frame it and just, I don't know, kind of how simple of an idea it is.
Yeah.
But
I'm now touching my body for lumps.
There will be some lumps. Some lumps are normal.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah. Right.
There's
right.
always going to be something.
Right.
Something with like mindfulness or just thinking about your health, considering your health. I've thought that maybe I'm not this way. Okay, you know how when you think a certain way, and maybe it's rare, and then you find out that everyone else, on average, thinks a lot differently. Or like, people say like, oh, people's biggest fear is public speaking.
Yeah.
And for me, I've always been cool with speaking in front of people. So it's like, when I hear that, I'm like, oh, okay. That's strange. But something for me, like, I've always thought about my health. I've always thought about my body. And not that I've had the best habits. Like, I've tried a lot of different things, tried experiments. But I don't know. I've just always had a kind of mindfulness for it. But it seems like a lot of people, like, that's such a triggering thing for them. Like, they almost, like, in pursuit of their own psychological health, they disconnect their relationship with their body and their health. Do you feel like this is an attribute you see a lot in people, or like that people are scared to think about it or talk about it, that they don't want to?
Yeah, that's a huge problem. And I've even seen it in myself, you know, like
I've seen it in myself for sure.
Yeah. Like I had high blood pressure and I knew it. It runs in my family.
Mm.
But part of me was like, well, you know, I don't want to go to the doctor to get it worked up because it's probably going to be due to, you know, some disease I have and I'm going to have all this stuff. But if I don't go get it checked out, you know, then I'll be fine, you know, and there's ignorance is bliss. And that's how a lot of people feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you'd rather not know, you know, there's a little problem, but is it going to be due to a big problem or is it just going to be a little problem?
Right.
And some people just don't want to know. And so, yeah, I mean, there's definitely that. It's kind of, you see it a lot in like the old tough guys, you know, that it's like that. We had a guy who came in, he had what's called pancytopenia, and it's where every blood cell line is low and it's almost always due to like a bone cancer.
Wow.
And he was just like, oh, I'm fine. And we were like, sir, you are not fine. It's like, right now you don't have any red blood cells to bleed, but if you did bleed, you don't have the platelets to stop it.
Wow.
And if, you know, it's like you would bleed to death, or you have no white blood cells, so you'll get an infection.
Jeez.
Something our bodies are constantly fighting off at all times is just going to ravage you and just take you.
Well, and it sucks that all that dude needs to hear, or needed to hear maybe 20 or 30 years ago, is, hey, it's okay. You need to tell people about, like, if something's hurting.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, people,
that's what's sad about it.
Some people have, like, stomach cancer, and they'll just have this, like, burning, gnawing pain in their stomach that they've had for years.
Mm.
And, you know, it's just like, they just, you don't want to know because you're afraid of what it might be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, like, there's a lot of people who, like, neglect their own health. I went to the doctor and I was like, you know what? I've got high blood pressure, whatever. Runs in my family. And they were like, well, what does your dad take? And I was like, oh, he takes this. Does it work for him? Yeah. Okay, here's some for you. That's it. You know, like, it's lot of the times, you know, it's not as scary as you think it would be. But yeah, a lot of people definitely like to like neglect their own health and everything. So.
Mm-hmm. I think with me, it was never, I felt something wrong. It was like not eating right.
Yeah.
And smoking.
More just like the general long term. You're like, I know this can't last.
Right. And there was always the thought in the back of my head where I'm like, I know what this is doing, but yeah. like, I'm still going to do it. And literally all it took was just one day making the, just a conscious decision.
Yeah.
Like, hey, I'm going to stop smoking. Yeah. I'm going to stop eating as much crap. I'm going to run.
Yeah.
Like
that's,
it sucks.
But easily the best decision you can make because there's always like, there's like two things that inevitably make everything worse. Like as we learn through every disease process in medicine, it's just like, you know, someone's got kidney disease. The things, two things that make it worse are diabetes and smoking. Like anything, anytime they're like, you know, they'll give you a, you'll be doing like a board question and it'll be like, so-and-so has pancreatitis and blah, 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 and this and that. And what's one of the one lifestyle modifications that they could make to improve their chances of surviving? And it's like, if smoking cessation or better blood sugar control are the answers, it's like, if it's on the options, that's always the answer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like smoking makes everything worse. Diabetes makes everything worse.
Mm-hmm.
Those are just the two things. And those are two things that are like ravaged. Like they just go through Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, diabetes and smoking in Oklahoma is just like.
Dude, they come in the same basket.
Yeah.
Like, the most common thing I hear is after a really big meal, like, man, I need a cigarette after that.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just like in this. And that was me at one point where you're just like, your brain tricks you into being like, man, I really need this cigarette.
Like so and so comes to the hospital and it's like, oh, what's their past medical history? Type 2 diabetes and COPD because they smoke and are diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, okay, well, I can tell them don't do that anymore. And they'll be like, uh-huh, can't you just give me a pill? And it's like, no, I can't.
Yeah.
This is the hard part where you actually have to do something to change your life. You know?
Yeah.
And it's doing the switch, like going from years of not taking care of my body to then taking care of it the past three months, I would say. It's like the weight gets smaller, but at the beginning of it, running with just all that like crap in my lungs and in my tummy and like on my body, like that was the worst part, was the first like 2 or 3 weeks
of just and that always is
reversing it and then it just gets easier from there.
Habits are hard to break.
One thing that's been truly imprinted on me forever from my experience, funny enough, being a delivery boy for like 5 years, is the cost of inaction. And like, maybe that sounds weird or crazy, but it's just, I would see these people over these just, you see hundreds and hundreds of people over and over again, and I'm going into two different hospitals. Sometimes you deliver people to their apartments, you deliver to them in the hospital, or you see them in the hospital. And you just see people that live these lives where you can tell they're truly stuck and drowning and attached to their vices to the point to where their bodies are rotting away in a painful, disgusting manner, and they still can't get themselves to do anything about it. And it's just, I saw so many different examples of this and the amount of suffering it brings and like, and just over and over again. And I don't know why, like lots of other people saw the stuff I saw, but didn't necessarily get the same message. But like, that's what was really imprinted on me, is like how many people seem to fall through the cracks and really, and it's not just that they fall through the cracks and like, oh, okay, well maybe they won't amount to anything, but they're going to do what they like and enjoy their life. But it's like, no, the cost of inaction, like it compounds. And it goes from like, oh, maybe they won't have opportunities, to it compounds to like, you're in physical pain, you're suffering, you're going to the hospital, you know, 3 times in 6 weeks, and those bills are racking up, and there's no one in your family that can pay for it, and you can't pay for it. And like, all the, and you just see so many examples of these, and it's just, it's a, I don't know, a weird, dark reminder and motivator for me that like, okay, my actions have real consequences, like, nature will devour me. Like as soon as it gets a chance, like it will eat me alive, or modern life, or whatever you want to call it. But
yeah, that's a good mindset to have. That's what will set you apart from everyone else. Just thinking that way, just not allowing yourself to fall victim to that. Totally.
Well, I hope so. If I keep on jumping over creeks, though, I might.
Yeah, you're gonna have to.
I might just like undo all that work.
Yeah. Did you have that mindset when you jumped over? I don't think you have that mindset when you jumped
over. I sound like such an idiot. But I was thinking about the if I could make it distance wise. I wasn't thinking about the height. So
that's where you
fuck up. But
yeah. Well, you can't be a stuntman. But at least you'll be a great software developer.
Yeah. I'm just glad that my bone wasn't sticking out of my leg.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be able to walk
that,
again.
I was kind of happy about that too. I was waiting for you to pull your pants up
and just see like,
oh no,
yeah.
Jesus.
Oh yeah. It was all. You see those videos on the internet, and it's like I was almost one of those dudes. Yeah. Their knee just like pops out of place, and their leg just goes sideways. Like I was.
You're
almost
probably
that
like
dude.
2 or 3 feet. Like if it was 2 or 3 feet higher, probably about a couple.
It's a lot of acceleration to happen in 2 or 3 feet.
Or maybe if I had smoked, maybe both my legs would just
that's true.
Both
of them
diabetic,
folded.
Your knees would have just went behind you and just hit your face on the ground with your feet on the ground as well. Yeah,
broke my teeth.
You would have flamingoed that itch.
Nice.
I did see a TikTok about that. A guy was on a wrestling ring and he jumps off the ropes.
Oh, I
when
saw
he lands,
no,
his knees go backwards entirely.
Dude, that's exactly the type of video I'm talking about. Or y'all ever watch Scarred? Or was it Scarred?
Yes, on MTV.
MTV, yeah.
Yes.
Like seeing someone's ankle pop, like just pop out of like.
Or like Hall of Meat on Instagram, the skaters. It's just an account
that's for
accidents that happen while skating. And it is 9 times out of 10, a bone flying out of place on the leg. Like either the knee, the ankle.
The one that gets me, though, is the head trauma. Ooh. Like people who aren't wearing a mask. Oh, geez. Here we are.
Wear a mask when you skate. You're endangering the.
Yeah, but people who aren't wearing a helmet and they just like fall backwards and their head just, you know, slams on the ground.
Yep.
Just because it's like
backwards.
Bones will heal.
Right.
But your brain can only take so much.
Because you're just imagining in the skull, like your brain just like. Kaploosh against the back of your skull, like
because your brain is moving just as fast as your entire head, and it's stopping just as quickly as well.
Yeah,
so
I often think about football, like playing football, like in junior high school. Like, I wonder if that like has any effect though on like high schoolers and
I mean,
what is CTE or something?
Mm-hmm,
like
that's it's a chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Okay,
that's what happens. As you get recurrent encephalopathy, as you get recurrent like concussions and stuff, it changes the architecture of your brain.
Wow.
And it basically,
it's crazy. It gives you a warrior's brain, basically.
Yeah. Like, yeah.
Just but like then, a primal, like
basically
stone slinging warrior's brain.
That or someone with Alzheimer's, because the proteins that build up inside the brain with CTE is the same proteins that can build up in Alzheimer's.
Wow.
So people basically get like super, super, super early onset Alzheimer's, get really depressed. And that's when you see those like NFL players that are killing themselves.
Yeah.
You know, like suicide and I mean, it's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It's really crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's scary. I've thought about it too with my son. I'm like, if he's like passionate about football, I'll consider
it.
Otherwise, I'm not going to be pushing football on my son.
Yeah.
Not at all. My wife, the school she went to, the high school, there was one of the players there and he got a concussion and then was cleared to play again. And he went to go tackle the quarterback and just fell back and just hit his head a little bit. It wasn't super hard, not as hard as the first time. And his brain just swelled up and he died. Like cerebral edema, just boom, and he's gone. And so,
Jeez.
For me, when I see like head trauma, I'm like, that's so bad. Like that is so bad.
Yeah.
I would rather have a horribly deformed leg and have to get it
or like a broken arm or something than having some head
trauma. Yeah, that
head
trauma is
no
joke.
Yeah.
That's the stuff that I'm like, now knowing what I know, I'm like, I can't watch that stuff.
Yeah, I bet.
I can handle the gore, but man, head trauma is just, it's a whole nother ball game.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I didn't land on my head then.
Yeah, me too. That's what I'm saying. At least it was your knee. Like some people, like for real.
honestly,
like their neck or their head or whatever.
I think I might have that warrior caveman brain you're talking about, because I'm just like,
I'm afraid
lift
I
heavy rock. Yeah. Lift heavy rock. Me lift stand rock. In sun, yeah. Good.
Yeah. Me jump like, creek.
Yeah. Yeah. It was funny, like when we were limping away, I had this like primal fear of like, sorry. Everyone else was fine. They just crossed the creek. They didn't jump in. But we were limping away, and I just had this like primal fear of like ancient hunter gatherer they're gonna like I broke my leg. Now I'm useless to them. Like there's not enough food for me. They're gonna kill me. Like they're gonna pity kill me or exile me, and I'm gonna get eaten by a wolf.
We're gonna get in the car and drive off without you. Yeah, you weren't fast enough to get there.
Maybe. They're like, can you? Hey, if you can make it to the car, you're still in the tribe. If not, well,
sorry, you know. Sleeping with the cows, buddy.
Yeah. Sucks to suck.
But quite a rip. Yeah. Thank you for coming on, Caleb.
Thank you for giving us your time today.
Seriously, thank you guys.
I think you are now officially the longest episode we've had.
Hell yeah.
So that's pretty soon
about it.
Really?
Yeah.
Nice. Hey,
if you got to edit it down, you can edit out some of the gold. But do not edit out Club Albie. We're going to go.
Yeah.
We're going to go to Club Albie. ALBEE.
Party it up.
Join us on Facebook.
Club Albie, we know that you're having a rough time right now. Yep. Like you need a podcast. You need to have more presence mm-hmm. in the digital space. So hit us up.
Sponsor these fine gentlemen.
All right. Yeah. Thanks, y'all.
Later.
Thanks.